loads on the radio, from an amazing story of a family reunited after 80 years to joint finances for couples and the beauty of freckles. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
And once myself and my brother and my father got in to see her, it was the only time we actually met her face to face in 9 years.
I've gone to professional people to look for advice, and I have been told straight out I would be better off if I quit my job, went on the dole and went away and got pregnant and had a child alone. I have been told I'd be far better off as a single mother, not working.
Some of these new variants, like the Mu variant, may be better able to penetrate the defences that we have thanks to our vaccines.
And to the live line and this incredible story told by 79-year-old Micheál McKeown about his 80-year-old sister, Patricia.
When is the last time you saw your sister, Patricia?
Never saw her, Joe. Okay. Haven't met her.
When will you meet her for the first time?
On the 10th, Friday week.
Tomorrow week.
I think that's, yeah.
That's incredible. So how did you link up again?
It all started with me doing a DNA test last February, 12 months.
Okay.
And my daughter did one at roughly the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my results back, and it just, the usual thing, it just showed I had some connections. Mostly my family, the McKeowns, are South Armagh, North Loud,
okay,
and Tarna, that area in Galway,
okay,
where my mother came from. And my daughter's DNA, which was done with a different company, showed a very, very close connection, a family connection, to some lady in England that we never knew about. We didn't know, okay, who this was. So it was suggested that I would send my DNA results to my daughter's company and they would merge them.
Okay.
They have a database that they can merge these things. When this happened, about 3 weeks afterwards, I'd completely forgotten about it. And I was sitting at my computer one day just doing some work or other. And the next thing was, I saw this email coming in and I started scrolling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this thing which gave some reading, which in the units that of relationship, it showed something like about 400 or 400 and something centimorgans, which is the units of how they rate these things. Relationship, and up came the word sibling.
Wow.
And I almost collapsed.
Yeah.
Because I had a sister who died, very unfortunately, 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
When I saw this sibling, I couldn't believe it. For a few seconds, I actually kind of said, what does sibling mean? You know, and I checked and I looked at it, and I checked then with the DNA results, and it meant that we had a common mother and father.
Wow.
That immediately, Joe, started. I told my family about it, that my daughters and my sons, they started doing some research. I then started doing some research, and for the first time, I found that my mother and father were married in Coolock, not in the village of Drumiskin, where she was teaching and where my father came from.
And have you spoken to your sister?
Oh, many times.
Oh, great.
Many times.
Great,
we've struck up a great relationship. We've had video calls and everything.
Oh,
and
magic. And how? And did she, who was driving this, if you follow me? Was she driving it?
She was driving it as much as, well, we knew nothing about it. She spent her life looking for her parents.
Wow.
Or her family.
Oh, my God.
She gave up the hunt maybe 10, 15 years ago. She just kept hitting cul-de-sacs.
Mm.
Even though she had private detectives and everything searching for her family. Now, her background is that she was adopted by a Protestant family in Belfast from a mother and baby home.
Okay.
She had a rather unfortunate upbringing with them. She didn't like them very much and they treated her terribly.
Okay.
She left and went into a home who reared her until she was 16, and she got her 11 plus exam, etc. She was a member of the Northern Ireland Youth Orchestra. Very, very...
Wow, well done.
She's a very good singer. I've heard her singing. And she was a viola player, and she actually played with James Galway. She's still a friend of his.
Fantastic.
Then, at the age of 18, or sometime shortly afterwards, she emigrated to England. And she met a man. She eventually got married and settled down. She went into banking and she became right up at the top level of banking. She became personal secretary to one of the top bank managers and worked at that all her life. And still spent all her time looking for her part family.
So as Michal and Patricia are full siblings, they have the same mother and father, Joe asked Michal how Patricia ended up being adopted.
Well, it appears that my mother was a governess to a local family in Drumiskin, very wealthy family.
Drumiskin is where?
County Louth.
County Louth, okay.
It's a coastal village, almost a coastal village. Fairly well known. It's about midway between Dundalk and Drogheda, something like that. My father was a young carpenter at the time from a farming family, fairly progressive farmers. And they started dating. And my mother became pregnant. And, of course, then they decided to get married. And they weren't allowed to get married in the village. They had to go to Coolock. Now, my belief is it was because of a rather tyrannical parish priest at the time.
So they weren't allowed to get married in the village of Drumiskin, where they were living, your mother was working. So they went to is that Coolock in Dublin?
Coolock in Dublin, for some strange reason. And I never knew this, and none of my family knew this. And it was never spoken about.
So they get married and Patricia comes along?
Yeah.
And why?
What happened, Joe, was even more complex than that, a more complicated thing. My mother went into a mother and baby home in Belfast 3 months prior to Patricia being born. Now, we've no reason why she did that. I know no reason why she would.
Because she was
that.
Married at the time.
She was married, and shortly after she was married, she went off to Belfast and admitted herself into a mother and baby home.
Okay.
And we have the records of that. We found the records.
But was she still, and both of them, were they still living and working in Drumiskin?
Well,
if they were getting from some quarters in the Drumiskin, if they were getting admonition, they might have felt, anyway.
They moved out of the village, that's for sure. I know actually where they moved to, about 10 miles away.
Okay.
And my father rented a house at that stage.
So your mother goes to Belfast, a mother and baby home, and Patricia, even though her parents are married, Patricia's put up for adoption.
She is.
Okay. Now, we'll come back to that in a sec. Did your parents, Michal, ever tell you about Patricia?
Never, Joe. Never a word, and it was never suspected.
And is Patricia the eldest in the family?
She is the eldest.
Ah, God.
And Michal spoke a bit about his mother's tragically short life.
She got ill 4 or 5 years after that. She got TB.
Okay.
And she had to go to a sanatorium. She lost a lung, had a couple of very serious operations, went to a sanatorium and spent 9 years in it. So there was very little contact between family and her. She was in Piemont and my father was forced to visit her up and down. And it was just shortly after the war.
Yeah.
He didn't have a car. He'd sold his car before the war.
So did you know your mother when you were growing up?
Joe, she used to write to me in Irish because she was a Gaelgeorie.
Okay.
And I used to get the local teacher to translate them.
Yeah.
And I'd write back in Irish after she... Yeah, that's the only way we communicated.
And what would she say in the letters?
Oh, she was very friendly. She always wanted to know how we were getting on.
And did she ever come home?
She came home for a year before she died. Now
just because the younger people don't remember, even hearing when they were growing up. I heard about it when I was growing up, about the great TB epidemic in the 1940s. But how long would go before you would see your mother? How long is the longest? Do you follow me? She was in hospital for 9 years.
We were brought on 2 or 3 trips to see her. We got out at the gates of Piemont, and she would come to the balcony of her ward, which was about 50 yards away and waved to us. And that happened twice.
In the 9 years?
Yeah. And once myself and my brother and my father got in to see her, shortly before she came home, I have a photograph of it. And it was the only time we actually met her face to face in 9 years.
That's Micheál's amazing story on the Live Line with Joe Duffy. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the WHO's Dr. David Nabarro on vaccination and the new variants.
I know you're monitoring at the World Health Organization a number of new COVID variants, one called Mu, which was first identified in Colombia in January. What more should countries, which are countries reopening like ourselves, what more can we do in terms of monitoring these new strains?
So I'd just like to actually reinforce what you said when you were introducing me. This virus causing the pandemic that we're living in at the moment does not show signs of going away. What happens is that it stays around, and then after a number of weeks, it will surge up in particular locations, and we can't always predict exactly where those are going to be, and it will cause problems. And then as we slightly adjust our behaviour, perhaps reducing the amount that we mingle up together, then the number of cases goes down. And then after a number of weeks, it'll come up again, and then it goes down again. We call these waves. And we're certainly experiencing a sequence of them in Europe right now, and that'll go on happening. So what I'd like to suggest to everybody is just continue to loosen up and restart life as you're doing. This is exactly what we should be doing with ourselves. But bear in mind, this virus is capable of returning. And that means I would like those who are able to continue to practice physical distancing, to not get too close to other people, particularly in confined spaces. And I would urge continued mask wearing. I also want those who are susceptible, who are perhaps older, or who are experiencing other diseases like diabetes, to be especially careful. And you could say to me, well, if you're vaccinated, surely you're okay. And my answer to that is no vaccine is 100% effective at preventing infection. And it does look as though some of these new variants, like the Mu variant that you've described, may be better able to penetrate the defences that we have thanks to our vaccines. And so please go on being careful. The thing is not over yet.
OK, now, when we talk about the vaccination rollout here, Ireland has done very well on that score. We have a very high level of the population fully vaccinated at this point. And of course, the booster programme has been discussed and is likely to start for the most vulnerable. But is the World Health Organization saying that it should start and end with the most vulnerable?
Well, for the moment, the thing that we are concerned about, because we look at the whole world when we're considering vaccination, the thing we're concerned about is this massive gap between what happens in wealthy countries, which includes Ireland, and what happens in poorer countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. The difference is just terrible. I mean, we have perhaps 2 or 3% of the eligible population vaccinated in sub-Saharan Africa, whereas we're up at much higher percentages in Ireland. And I mean, 62.8% is the figure that I have. I'm sure it's higher than that now, of Irish population fully vaccinated. What we're saying
is, I think we're in the high 80s at this stage, fully vaccinated over the age of 16.
I mean, even better. So we're just saying, you know, why don't you hold off on these boosters? Give them to the ones who really need boosters, because we suspect they have much weaker immune responses. But as for the rest, why not let other countries in the world get vaccines? Because each time Ireland or UK or United States kind of buys up hundreds of thousands of doses or millions of doses. It's basically taking that vaccine away from poor countries because there's a global shortage of well-tested vaccines, and I want more vaccines, and WHO wants more vaccines going to poorer countries if at all possible.
Dr. David Nabarro from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, before the publication of the new Housing for All plan, Amy Ní Riadha was speaking to some people desperately waiting for a home.
I've gone from a size 14 down to a size 6 just from not being able to eat and nourish myself. I have long-term medication that I'm supposed to be on that I can't afford to get because all my money goes on rent and bills.
Grace, who lives in Tralee, County Kerry, has been on the social housing waiting list for 7 years and she sees no way off it.
I'm 26 years old. Still on the waiting list, will probably be on the waiting list for another 10 or more years because I'm a single person with no dependents and no family and stuff.
Even though she has a full-time job, she says her willingness to work has actually hindered her chances of getting a house.
I've been told I'd be better off unemployed. I mean, I've gone to professional people to look for advice and I have been told straight out I would be better off if I quit my job, went on the dole and went away and got pregnant and had a child alone. I have been told I'd be far better off as a single mother not working. It's sad in a way to be told you'd be better off than that when you have the ability and you have the want to go out and work and make a better life for yourself.
For Rachel O'Sullivan in Greystones, County Wicklow, she says having children was not the answer to her efforts in securing a home.
We cut our own cloth. We went on to have 5 children. You know, that's what we wanted. We wanted a big family. But we've sacrificed a home because of that.
Rachel's husband is earning 3 times the national average wage. And yet in 10 weeks' time, when her lease is up, her family is facing the very real threat of becoming homeless.
We have mortgage approval for, you know, almost €500,000. You know, month by month, it's getting further and further out of our reach. It's just watching the market. It's just like, it's heartbreaking. It's soul destroying.
Moving out of Greystones isn't an option for Rachel's young family. And despite looking to buy for the last 2 years, the O'Sullivans haven't even gotten to bidding stage.
When you go to view places now, there's already offers in, you know, 40, 50 grand over the asking price. And houses are few and far between in Greystones. And when you're standing in the house viewing it, there's literally somebody outside the door waiting to come in. You've got like 5 minutes to walk around a house.
Others haven't even gotten to the viewing stage because house prices are just too high, even with 2 stable wages coming in.
Connie O'Connor, I live in Glenbey. I'm originally from Carseveen and I'm trying to settle down with my fiance in the Glenbey area. Frustrating is the word I'd use. Very difficult to find houses, and when they do come up, they're either outside our price range, but they don't last more than a couple of days before they're actually gone off the market again, you know.
For Connie, he'd rather build, but planning laws have restricted his options.
Unfortunately, because we're both not from the Glenbey area, we have to buy really, because we've been advised by several auctioneers that we wouldn't be able to get planning if we bought a site because we don't have a history with the area.
While all 3 contributors are in very different situations, they all have hopes and expectations for today's Housing for All plan. Rachel O'Sullivan and Connie O'Connor again.
That if a couple are willing to settle down in an area, in a rural area, and be part of the community and make that area their home and please God, raise a family there, that the planning process should be a little bit easier. That should be taken into account as opposed to, well, you've no history with the area, you're not going to get planning. I mean, that's a very blunt response for somebody who has fallen in love with an area.
I would love to see a vacant house tax. I think this country badly needs it. I can sit into my car and drive 2 minutes from our house and we have new build estates that have houses empty almost 4 years. Those houses are for sale for 585,000. They will not accept an offer under that. But those houses are empty and they have been for 4 years.
For Grace and Tralee, she just wants to be supported by a government that she says has forgotten her.
It's very easy to support someone who doesn't have a job, who doesn't have a regular income, who are already on social welfare. What I'd like to see is support for people who are out there bursting themselves week in, week out, just trying to keep a roof over their head, trying to keep bread on the table. Support for them.
Amy Ní Riada's report for Morning Ireland. Then later on the live line, Joe was looking at the plan.
Okay, the Housing for All plan is being announced today. 300,000 new houses by the end of 2030. 4 billion euros spent every year. An end to homelessness by the end of the decade. 90,000 social housing. 36 affordable properties. 18,000 homes designated cost rentals, which would rent 25% below the market rate. The remaining 156,000 homes will be delivered, that's 52%, will be delivered through the private market. Vacant properties and sites to be taxed. And apparently, if you have property above a shop, you can change it into residential without planning permission. And 500 homes per year upgraded through repair and leasing scheme for bringing vacant properties into use, which is where our caller comes in. And his name is John Galligan. John, good afternoon.
Hiya, Joe.
Tell us your story, please. And what
I sent you in a photograph of my aunt's former residence. My aunt, God love her, Aunt Joan, died in her 90s in December last.
Okay.
And just for pig iron, I went down there last week to see how the new residents were getting on.
Because it's public housing, it's council housing.
It's a tiny one-bed apartment in Blackrock. And sort of half suspecting that I might find what I did find, and that was that the house is still boarded up. Now, they have put in a new kitchen. You can see that from outside. And they've done some work inside. I don't know how much. But the point that I would make is that she died on the 9th of December. The keys were handed back in January or early February. Mm-hmm. And this is now September.
Good point.
And that place is still empty. It's still boarded up, still empty.
And it's not. And you're not talking about a seven-bedroom house. You're talking about one-bedroom
property. This is a tiny one-bedroomed property. Tiny, tiny. I've sat in it many, many times with Joan. And it's just a tiny place.
And it'd be for people living on their own or whatever.
It would be for someone living on her own, yeah. And it suited her very well. It's a lovely little apartment.
Yeah.
I could refurbish that place on my own in 2 weeks. With a team of guys, it could be done in a week. If that was a private rented apartment, someone would have been living there 8 months ago. I've no doubt about that. And I think it's just an absolute disgrace. I was very taken by a contribution on another phone-in programme last week by a lady who was bemoaning problems she was having with the school transport system.
Yeah.
And what struck me was she called directly at the staff in the Department of Transport, and she said, do your job. Do your job. You are paid enough. Don't give me COVID. Don't give me a lack of resources. Do your job. And, you know, I applied that to this situation, and I thought, someone is not doing their job. When that is taking 9 months to refurbish a tiny little apartment, and in the meantime, the people who would be in that apartment could well be living in boxes. And that's unacceptable.
Well, that's John on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Ray is the Fresh Prince of Kildare, don't you know?
Jaberai Banks was announced as the person who's going to play the Fresh Prince in the reboot of the Fresh Prince of Kildare. I'm a bit disappointed, I have to say, because I thought if ever it came back, that I'd be the person, you know, and I've been practicing the rap for the opening, you know, that everybody knows that they do it as their party piece. I've been practicing away, and I should have sent it to Will Smith, because he's one of the executive producers. I should have sent it to him, and then he would have considered me, you know. I just put it in an email. Count myself in. 1, 2, 3. Now this is a story all about how I like a flip turned upside down. I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there, and I'll tell you how I became the Prince of Kildare. In West Philadelphia, born and raised, on the playground was where I spent most of my days. Chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cool. I was shooting some b-ball outside of the school when a couple of guys who were up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood. I got into a little fight and my mom got scared. She said, "You're moving with your auntie and uncle to Kildare." I
I whistled for a cab when it came quite near. The license plate said fresh and it had a dice in the mirror. If anything I can say, this cab is rare. But I thought, nah, forget it. You're home to Bel Air. I pulled up to the house about 7 or 8 and then I yelled to the cabbie, you're home, smell you later. I looked at my kingdom, I was finally there, sitting my throne in the town of Kildare.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Hey, Darcy, in the afternoon. And in the morning, author Cecilia Ahern was talking to Ryan Tuberty about her new book, Freckles.
As soon as I saw the name Freckles, I always remembered that quote I was talking about this morning, which is that I saw in an art place about a face without freckles is like a sky without stars.
I've never even heard that. And that's so interesting.
That's because it features it. Go on, talk about it.
Yeah, no, sorry. It's your show.
Yeah, but you're my guest.
It's my
book. I'd be nothing without you.
Yeah. And so basically the character, her nickname is Freckles because she has freckles. And from an early age, she used to join them dot to dot in her skin, but to mirror the constellations in the sky. And I didn't know that expression.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. But I suppose I have freckles. I have lots. So yeah, That's something that I always used to do. Not necessarily with a pen, but like you just kind of have that dot to dot
join
thing
the
in my
dots.
Head. Yeah.
Why did you go with freckles? Because I find when I speak to children of a certain age, for years they don't know they have them.
Yeah.
And then they think that's because that's who they are. And then they heard a certain age and they go, these things drive me mad.
I know, yeah.
It's desperate because, you know, obviously they're
well,
beautiful.
I grew up with them, but I remember everyone saying to me, oh, you're freckle faced. You know, like I think people are a little bit more subtle now. Don't point out things on your face. But I don't mind my freckles. But for a while, they did bother me. But the reason why I called it freckles is because the character, so her mother is Spanish, but left her when she was born. And her dad is Irish and has these freckles. And she looks like her mother, but has freckles. And for her, it's the thing that connects her to her dad. And so she says that her mom, you know, gave up her to have everything, but her dad gave up everything to keep her. So that's the thing that connects the two of them. I know.
Allegra.
Yes.
Introduce Allegra to everyone because she is an intriguing traffic warden. And we need to talk about all these things. So why don't we get the potted history of the book, story of the book, and then we'll launch from there. How about that?
Okay, so it's about Allegra, whose nickname is Freckles, who is a parking warden, as you said. And she hears this expression, you are the average of the 5 people you spend the most time with. And it immediately makes her examine the 5 people in her life and what their characters say about who she is. But she realises she's not too happy with what she discovers and realizes that if she can choose a very specific set of 5 people, then she can become whoever she wants to be. She can kind of curate her life, upgrade herself, you know, reshape who she is. And so she reaches out to different areas of life, like someone in sports, someone in business, someone in politics, someone from her past that she wants to get to know, and a secret, someone else that I won't name. And she is very peculiar and very, because she's a parking warden, I wanted to have someone who's very rigid and strict with the rules, like in work, not necessarily in her other life, which is quite fluid. And when she hears this expression said by a very angry guy that she keeps ticketing, who has a yellow Ferrari that just offends her, and he never pays for parking. He's kind of ripping up the ticket in her face and says, you are the average of the 5 people you spend the most time with. And he says it like a bad thing and she takes it like it's an insult. It just turns her world upside down. You know, it just kind of tilts her off her access of her. And she just.
And so it begins.
And so it begins. Yeah.
OK, let's go back a few steps here. That expression, I'd never heard the expression before until I read this book. And I wasn't sure what it meant necessarily. Yeah. And had you heard it before somebody said it to you?
My lovely brother-in-law, Nicky.
Nicky Byrne.
Yeah. Said it to me when my. He couldn't. Somebody said something in the room and he didn't know whether it was me and my mom because we're morphing into each other. And he says, was that you or your mom? You know, you're the average of the 5 people you spend the most time with. Choose wisely. And the choose wisely bit to me seems kind of threatening. So I immediately started thinking of somebody, a character hearing this and not taking it in the best way, you know. Yeah. But it is a Jim Rohn quote. He is a business motivational speaker.
Ah, OK.
And so it's really for people in the business world, as if. Like in a very easy way to explain it. Like if you're surrounded by successful people, you will become successful. And that's kind of, you know, the law of the rules of attraction.
Yes,
and,
yes, yes.
But I suppose it's, it can be, the question can be asked at different phases of your life. You know, it's not the five people who shape your entire life. It can be at one specific point. Examine those five people. Did they, you know, inspire you in some way? Did they, did they shape you? Did they make you make certain decisions? I think it's just a really interesting question.
It is an interesting question. And what I was thinking as I was reading, and I was going through just like Allegra going, who would you call and say, like, let's hang out? It felt like, you know, your five dinner party guests almost. Yeah. You know, it had that feel to it. It's a good conversation point, if nothing else.
And guess who almost made it into the book?
Can we talk about the late night TV show that is on TV in the book that features a new presenter as well?
Yes.
What's
Do you know what's so funny?
What's her name?
I actually had you in this and I took you out because I thought...
Get out.
Do you know what?
Take an outbreak.
I thought I can't put words. I hate when people take characters who exist and put words in their mouth. I think that's really weird. So I was either going to have to text you and say, Ryan, like, can I have you say this? Which is just weird.
I would have been honoured.
Would you?
I would have been honoured.
Okay, the next one I'll do. I just thought, no.
As long as it's not mean.
Didn't think, no, it was just going to be like introduction. But then I thought, he might not like how he's introduced the guest.
You want a little help with the lines I might use?
I'm not a presenter. I don't know.
I'll be a consultant on the next one.
But it's not the Late Late Show. I called it something else.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's why I didn't say the Late Show. I said it's a late night chat show with is it Jasmine Chu?
I can't remember, but yeah.
Well, I'll tell you. Have you read the book? Okay. Other things I wanted to ask you about is, can I ask you about introverts? I found that really interesting. You strike me as being once upon a time more introverted than you are now. Mm. I think you come to interviews with two minds. One is, I've got to get through this. One is, I should kind of enjoy it once I'm in there. It's like looking at a cold the sea. If I get myself there, mostly on a Friday night when I look at it going, ooh, and then once you're in, it's okay. As long as you're comfortable, that kind of thing. And then there was, I'm not even going to talk about the last 18 months, but it just... When I go to schools and I see the kids that don't have the hand up, I'm often saying, if you don't put your hand up, that's okay too.
Oh my God, yeah. Well, I was that girl, you know, it was very quiet.
And now, where are you with all of that?
I'm what's probably called an extroverted introvert.
Yeah, no, I've heard of this. So that's
And it's not necessarily about shyness or anything. I've learned that it's more about how people kind of express themselves and how you, so I would kind of get drained by people.
Yeah.
Even though I like people,
in what
but
way,
you know, like I kind of, I suppose, I'm very sensitive to people and all the energy. So if I need to go away and be by myself and kind of process it, and then I'm ready to go out again, you know. So if people are high energy or whatever, I get like,
it's too much.
So that's it. So I think it's, you know, and whereas some people get their energy from other people and they need to be with other people.
Yeah.
So while I love people as well, I think it's just an introvert definitely needs to go to themselves and into themselves for a while to recharge.
Yeah, but you strike me as growing in. Have you grown in confidence? Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
would you say that's true?
Yeah, yeah.
And Ryan asked Cecilia about working with Nicole Kidman.
And how are you with success these days? I mean, you're just getting it's enormous. It's kind of getting. But you're working with Nicole Kidman at the moment.
Yes. That's on my book of short stories, Roar, which I came in to talk to you about. And it's for Apple TV Plus, which is amazing. It just wrapped a few days ago.
Well done.
So there's 8 half-hour episodes. And we don't have a release date yet.
What was so great about Roar was it brings us back to young Mary Poppins viewing Suffragette Cecilia. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a natural arc here.
Yeah.
And then you write these gorgeous stories that will empower, you know, Robin and my girls and, you know, young women everywhere, particularly girls as opposed to, you know, women to an extent. And now you've got Nicole Kidman on a Zoom call shooting the breeze. How's that?
It's incredible. Like, it's just particularly that collection of stories because it was, I wrote it on the side, really. You know, it was something I was writing for me and I desperately wanted it to be a TV series. I didn't know it would be published. I didn't think it would be something that my publishers would want because it's very different. So I, from the very beginning, like this is almost, you know, 7 years ago. Gosh, it's ages ago, 10 years ago, probably. So I'm just feel so honoured that these incredible women, like there's such a huge cast. There's a different actor in each episode.
Can you give us an
idea? Yeah, Cynthia Erivo from Harriet. Then there's Alison Brie, Betty Gilpin, Mira Sayal. And there's some people that we haven't announced yet. So it's
Those ones.
No, I know. I'd love to.
Okay.
But just such an fast.
How's Nicole Kidman to do business with?
Oh my, she's such a pro. Like she's so professional, so talented, and really, into all aspects. So she's producing this with her company, Blossom Films.
Congratulations, that's wonderful.
So she's just, they know exactly what they're doing. I think you mentioned the show that's on now, Nine Perfect Strangers.
And also Big Little Lies, and that's Leanne Moriarty. Yeah. And then you have...
The Undoing
is great fun.
Yeah.
And you have Reese Witherspoon in the middle. These are amazing, because they're like Legally Blonde, or whatever movies you saw them in, and now they're powerhouses behind the scenes as well as in front of camera.
And I think what they're doing is making women-centric stories, and I think because there just weren't enough. And
but they're not just for women, are they?
They're entertaining for everyone. I think and I know people get a bit annoyed when you go women, like it's really, really annoying, but you notice the difference when you're watching a TV show and suddenly the woman's at the centre of the story and they're not just the wife. Like, for a woman, that's really exciting. It's like seeing, when you're a kid watching a superhero and you think, I can be that person. And when you see someone that kind of you feel represents you, it does a lot for the viewer and for your own soul.
Cecilia Ahern from The Ryan Tuberty Show. And in the morning, those deleted texts. Anya Lawler was talking to Fianna Fáil TD Barry Cowan.
And let's talk about some of the new questions that arise in terms of ministerial texts. Barry Cowan, Fianna Fáil TD for Leigh Shoffley and member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, is in our Athlone studio. Good morning, Barry Cowan.
Good morning, how are you?
So you heard Simon Coveney on Tuesday at the Oireachtas Foreign Affairs Committee. You questioned him yourself. What was your impression then? And what's your impression this morning?
It's just something that fails to go away despite many efforts by those concerned to draw a line under various aspects of it. And it's very disconcerting, it's very disappointing, and it doesn't sit well with us still. First and foremost, I want to say that the appointment didn't ultimately go ahead. That's to be welcomed. The public backlash that I've said previously was warranted. I couldn't understand in the first place how the cabinet didn't cry stop. The appointment smelt of a divvy up then, irrespective of whether anyone was blindsided or not. I think those within cabinet should have recognised this for what it was. Minister Coveney subsequently apologised to the Taoiseach for the manner in which it was brought to cabinet and acknowledged that Taoiseach and other Fine Gael ministers were only aware of the detail that day. Further apologised and acknowledged that such business will have to be done differently in future. A transparent, open competition for such positions will have to be in place if such envoys are to be appointed in the future. And that, we felt, was the end of the story. The Oireachtas Committee, as you alluded to, met this week to formalise clearly that no such similar appointments of such a nature would happen again in the future. But in the course of that discussion, debate and questions, the Minister Coveney appeared to inform the committee that others were a lot more aware of a lot more of the details that had previously been thought or expressed by him in various interviews with yourselves and others. And that, couldn't be confirmed specifically because he hadn't the detail of the texts. And subsequently, as has been said, the Taoiseach made those texts available. The Taoiseach acknowledged the texts and information contained therein relating to government business should not be deleted, but doesn't allude to the fact about the startling information that's contained within those texts in relation to the amount of knowledge that was known by the parties involved, and that a contract and agreement had been reached with Catherine Sapone, who was very happy and looking forward to the role while nobody else was aware of it.
What does it say about the authority of the Taoiseach? And admittedly, you've gone through it and there was the apology and we'll move on and then we've learned what we've learned since. But what does it say about the authority of a Taoiseach who is blindsided by such an appointment at Cabinet, and it's being discussed by his coalition partners in Fine Gael 11 days in advance? A contract is being drawn up and nobody thinks to mention it to the Taoiseach?
Exactly.
Well, what does that say about your party leader?
Well, what it says in the first instance, he nor any of the cabinet shouldn't have been blindsided. But as I said to you, irrespective of that,
what should it was he do very about
poor, it? I do believe it was very poor judgment on the part of everybody at cabinet to allow this appointment to be put through in the first instance. You know, I'd like to think if I was sitting at that table, I would have cried foul. Stop.
Yeah, but you
There's
had
no
to resign,
this should
didn't
have been
you?
Done.
You had to resign and Dara Cailleary had to resign. And I'm sure the question is going to be asked at that Fianna Fáil gathering next week. Are Fine Gael ministers getting away with breaches at Cabinet that Fianna Fáil ministers have to resign for?
Yes, that is something that is being said within our organisation and indeed by members of the public. And, you know, if somebody wants to draw a line under this, they better do so quickly and move on to much more pertinent, much more important business of government that needs to be addressed, not least the one that was referred to by Michael Lahan in relation to the housing crisis. We specifically went into government, despite having had a poor election, with the intention of addressing this issue. And over 12 months later, we now have a plan that has 4 billion per annum available to address it. And here we are talking about this issue.
And I have a question for you on that coming up. But just to get clarity on this, you say you had to resign, Dara Cailleary had to resign, Fine Gael ministers need to find a way to move past this. Will that take resignations at this stage?
Look, it's up to the parties involved to meet and decide what they wish to do. All I'd say is during the course of the issues concerning the matter and the incident for which I was held responsible, you know, I was told that this issue was dominating the public domain and was getting in the way of government business. Some would argue that this is getting in the way of very difficult government business too.
Would it be the honourable thing for Leo Varadkar or Simon Coveney to resign
If they feel so, that's their decision to make. If they don't feel so and the Taoiseach has a judgement to make, well, that's his business.
Then later, Anya spoke to Minister for Higher Education, Fine Gael's Simon Harris.
This row, and particularly this very clear statement now from Barry Cowan, that he, as he sees it, he was sacked because controversies involving him were overshadowing the work of government. We're talking now not about third level, but about this latest controversy, another apology this morning. This is no way to be doing government business, is it?
Well, I think everybody across government and the three parties in government have fully accepted that this entire process could have and should have been handled differently. Minister Coveney himself has said that. But I think it is important to put a sense of perspective on this. Minister Coveney went before the committee. He answered questions for around 2 hours. He himself was the person who volunteered information in relation to the text messages. I believe he answered the questions honestly and as comprehensively as he could. No doubt, though, it's a statement of fact to say there's other members of the committee, many members of the committee now looking for further clarifications. And I expect that Minister Coveney will robustly provide clarifications and indeed rebuttal to any assertion that he has been inconsistent or misled any committee. I know Simon Coveney well.
Were you aware, for
he's
instance,
honest,
that Simon Coveney's phone has been hacked?
I don't believe I was. No, I don't believe I was.
Do you delete text messages?
In relation to government business, I think you'll know, Anya, I think many journalists will know, a number of my text messages relating to government business have appeared on the front pages of newspapers through FOI, Paul Reid, Tony Hulan, for example, when I was Minister for Health. So I don't routinely. But Minister Coveney has outlined to the committee, and I'm sure will further expand today, on why he believed it was appropriate to do that from a security point of view. And it's for Minister Coveney to provide that clarification, and I've no doubt he will.
Should the minister be deleting text messages from his phone?
Well, I think the Taoiseach's statement last night was very clear in relation to what's best practice, very clear in relation to our obligations under the Freedom of Information, but also very clear, and this hasn't been as widely quoted, also very clear about the cybersecurity advice that ministers may be provided with. And it's not for me, I'm not privy to that advice, but Minister Coveney has referenced those security concerns and I'm sure he will expand on them further today. I spoke to Minister Coveney last night. I know he is only too willing to provide any further clarifications required to provide people with the information they need. I'm also conscious that a lot of us are talking about this, knowing that there will be paperwork, the Minister has said, to be published from the Department of Foreign Affairs, showing the process that was followed internally in the Department of Foreign Affairs. And I think that'll be helpful for the committee in their inquiries also.
You said the Minister, Minister Coveney will provide clarification. And this morning we have that statement from Leo Varadkar. Would you resign? Would it be the honourable thing to resign in this situation, given that this controversy is overshadowing the work of government?
Absolutely not. I'm not sure how this controversy is overshadowing the work of government. Today, the government will launch the most ambitious housing plan ever. I'm here today to talk about getting 300,000 people back to college for the first time since the start of the pandemic. And indeed, Minister Coveney and his department are now chairing the UN Security Council for the month of September. The government is working. This week, we saw an incredible plan, really, to try and ease the restrictions and indeed disappear many of the restrictions in the coming weeks. So the government is working flat out on the issues of concern to the people. This is an issue of concern in relation to the Oireachtas Foreign Affairs Committee members have raised questions. The minister will be only too happy to comprehensively respond to
them. Oh, it's not just a foreign affairs matter, because what Barry Cowan was talking about here is that all of this amounts effectively to a challenge to the authority of the Taoiseach. He made it very clear. He was sacked. He was made very clear to him by the Taoiseach he needed to go so the work of government could continue. Dara Cailleary went into a phone call and came out of it believing very clearly it was expected that he would resign. And the Taoiseach has a judgment to make. Why should it be a different rule for Dara Cailleary and Barry Cowan than Leo Varadkar or Simon Coveney?
Because I think we need to take a step back here and remember what Simon Coveney was endeavouring to do. He was endeavouring to appoint a special envoy to advocate in relation to LGBTQ rights and to make sure that Ireland was well positioned during its time of the Security Council.
Barry Cowan called it a divvy up.
Well, I don't accept that. I don't accept that. And I think it's important. I think it's important that we allow the minister answer the questions that the committee want. I think it's also important that we take the time not to suppose things, but to read the paperwork from the Department of Foreign Affairs. And I don't think people are comparing apples with apples here. Minister Coveney was going about his job. He was endeavouring to appoint a special envoy, somebody who nobody has suggested would not have been qualified to do a very good job. He has admitted very clearly many weeks ago that the process followed in terms of the Taoiseach not being informed was not right, and indeed apologised to the Taoiseach, and indeed the Tánaiste also apologised to the Taoiseach and the leader of the Green Party in relation to this. Lessons have been learnt and lessons must be learnt in relation to that, but I do think there needs to be a sense of perspective in relation to this.
Then later, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald.
Well, Áine, what we've seen here has been just the latest instalment of insider crony cosy politics around Fine Gael in particular, but the government more generally. It's clear that a makey-up job was provided for a friend of government, in this case Catherine Zappone. It's clear now that as the information has emerged that despite protestations at the beginning that in fact there was lobbying underway for this job, it's clear that both Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney were across all of this and the Taoiseach was kept in the dark. And it's also clear that Simon Coveney was less than forthcoming at the committee and in fact offered incomplete and misleading information to the committee. So the first thing that needs to happen, Áine, is the minister needs to go back into the committee and needs to give a full, frank and credible explanation as to what happened. And in fact, we've written to the committee and to the committee chair to ask that that happens without delay. I think what also needs to happen is the Taoiseach does need to take action. I mean, it is incredible that yet again we see the head of government blindsided by the two principals from Fine Gael. And that when something like this emerges, that the Taoiseach fails to take action. We all know that the government makes appointments and that's part of governance. But there have to be procedures, there has to be oversight, there has to be transparency. You know, being in government, Áine, isn't a green light or a carte blanche for anybody to look after their mates and friends, whether that's leaking documents to them, confidential documents, or making up jobs and roles for them. It's entirely unacceptable. And in fact, it's the very worst face of that old time crony Fianna Fáil Fine Gael politics that people are sick to the back teeth of, that undermines confidence in government and in politics more generally. So the minister needs to now go back to the committee, set out the full facts. And what we've seen here, I believe, has been the invention of a makey-up job for a friend and then a desperate effort to cover their tracks, including deleting texts, giving incomplete information in response to FOI requests and so on. So the whole thing stinks to the high heavens.
And then later, Alan Kelly, leader of the Labour Party, was talking to Claire Byrne.
So Barry Cowan's intervention this morning on Morning Ireland was significant. He said the Taoiseach has a decision to make here, and he was referencing his own sacking. He was told that his situation last year was impacting the work of government, overshadowing the work of government. Is he right?
I think he is. It seems to me there's an Orwellian feel to this, that some ministers are more equal than others. Simple fact of the matter is the Taoiseach was very willing to sacrifice two of his own ministers. But he knows full well that if he was to go near Fine Gael or indeed a Green minister, probably this government would fall. So really this all boils down to the functioning of this government. And it seems to me at this stage and to the public that the Taoiseach is willing to put up with anything. His authority is completely undermined. It's obvious that Fine Gael knew all about this issue a significant period beforehand. They tarnished the new 11 days beforehand on the 16th. The contracts were being drawn up for Catherine Sapone on the 19th. I'd like to ask quite publicly what other Fine Gael ministers were aware of and when in relation to this issue. And if this is the way the government, apart from the actual appointment, if this is the way the government functions, where Fine Gael basically just act on their own, completely undermined the Taoiseach because they know he won't do anything because he's actually afraid. We have a Taoiseach who's afraid of his government partners. Well, then that's not a functioning government. And then there's a whole range of other issues, obviously, regarding FOI. So many questions relating to the FOI put in by Jack Power and Jack Horgan-Jones and others. And then there's the issues in relation to leaking. And I mean, I find it unbelievable that Catherine Martin came on there earlier on and said that, you know, the leaking was an internal matter for Fine Gael. It's not. It's for the government, of which she's a part. And secondly, it was quite interesting that she fingered Fine Gael for the leaking. So it's obvious what she thinks there.
Alan Kelly on Today with Claire Byrne, then later on the News at One.
The Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, is willing to offer further clarifications on the botched appointment of Catherine Sapone as a UN envoy, according to Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. Mr. Convey, who's admitted deleting text messages relating to the appointment, is being asked to appear before the Oireachtas Foreign Affairs and Defence Committee to answer further questions surrounding the controversy. Earlier, the Taoiseach apologised that text messages of his involving Catherine Sapone, requested by journalists, had not been released as required. He said that he was on annual leave and wasn't contacted. Former Fianna Fáil Minister Barry Cowan said the controversy was distracting from the work of government. Asked on Maureen Ireland if the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Taoiseach should resign, he said that's their decision. If they don't feel so, the Taoiseach has a decision to make. Here's the Taoiseach speaking in Uri this morning.
Well, you know, just to say from my point of view, I think I've dealt with this matter. I've set out very clearly what my involvement was in this appointment, which of course did not take place in the end of the day. And I've published all the records that I have, which I believe verify my account. I was only in contact with Simon Coveney on one occasion about this matter, and that was essentially the query that you've seen. As you can see from the text message, he informed me that a memo would go to Cabinet. That is the normal way these things are done. And a memo did go to Cabinet. It was on the agenda the Friday before the meeting, in fact. But what didn't happen and what should have happened, and I've acknowledged this some weeks ago, what should have happened is either he or I should have flagged this appointment to Minister Ryan and to the Taoiseach because it was potentially politically sensitive.
The Taoiseach also said the issue was not causing a distraction for government.
I don't think it's being overshadowed. It's certainly a shadow, but I don't think it's overshadowing what is a really important day for government and for the country. Bear in mind, the real big news stories of this week are the government's COVID plan, which we published only yesterday, and the government's Housing for All plan, which we're going to publish today. So we're focusing as a government on COVID, on housing, on the big challenge at hand. Certainly nobody in government is distracted anyway from the business of government, if others are.
The Taoiseach is speaking in Uri in County Down this morning.
The News at One with Brian Dobson. Money, it can be a contentious issue for people in a relationship. So on Today with Claire Byrne, people in Cork, we're talking about those joint accounts.
Do you think most couples have joint accounts these days?
I would say yes, but after a period of time. I think even in my generation, there was independence before financial marriage came, we might call it. But I'd say younger people are a bit more independent than even we are now. People are going to keep their accounts separate. Whereas in our case, I think as the relationship became more serious, you got married and naturally blended together, I think.
So as you blended together, the accounts blended together?
Financially, everything came together, yeah.
Lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, sounds nice. But now, would you? I'm an accountant, and so is my wife. And so is my wife. So.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so that might just take that steer on it when you're talking to me.
God, I said there's not too much messing with the joint accounts with you, is there?
No, it's just bills. You know, it's just put in the money, pay your bills and so on.
What about the anniversary flowers now? Do they come out of the joint account?
No.
The Valentine's Day box of chocolates?
No. That would be independent on both sides.
Oh, I think that people are more independent of each other and definitely separate accounts.
It was practical in the sense that maybe a lot of women didn't work.
And how long before you've gone out with someone do you say, will we join our accounts together?
You'd have to have a real commitment. That would have to be, you'd have to be committed.
So then Owen McGee, presenter of How to Be Good with Money, and Barbara Scully, writer and broadcaster, joined Claire in studio.
Owen, joint account or separate bank account? Some people feel the joint account idea is old-fashioned. Do you agree?
Yeah, well, it really depends. I know couples who would absolutely split up if they had a joint account, and couples who would absolutely split up if they didn't have a joint account. And it really comes down to the communication between the two people, what suits that couple, and it's not one size fits all. Now, I would say it is important. I believe it's important that each person, if you do have a joint account, has their own money too. And I remember talking to a therapist or a counsellor about this, in a pub or something, I'm sure it was. But I was talking to them and they said, oh no, and they were horrified by the idea that you'd have your own money. This used to be called runaway money.
Yes, yeah, the runaway, running away fund.
It's not, it's called an F-off fund now is what it's called. It's not called a runaway money anymore. That's old school. But the runaway money is something that's really important. But the joint account, it really depends on the couple. And couples fight over this. And particularly couples who are bringing it together for the first time, where one says, we really need a joint account, and the other one is resisting it. That can cause big friction.
Yeah, what's your take on it, Barbara?
I'm a firm believer in joint accounts, and I'm a firm believer in transparency, and I'm a firm believer in everybody knowing what's going on. I mean, to me, if you are going to set up shop with somebody, regardless of your gender, regardless of whether you're getting married or not, but if you're committing to what you're hoping is going to be the rest of your life relationship, and you're going to embark on the biggest purchasing decision you'll ever make, which is buying a house if you're lucky, and having children and raising children, I don't understand why you wouldn't pool your resources.
Everything.
Into like joint
all
account.
Of the money into a joint account.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested by one of the Vox Poppers who said each of you putting 10% into your own separate little account to have, if you like, a kind of petty cash fund that you can buy the flowers with or whatever, or perhaps need it as a running away money. But I believe firm, and it's funny because very often the running away money, as it was called, is seen as quite a feminist thing. You know, don't be dependent on me. My mother would have said to me, don't ever make yourself totally dependent on a man. Always make sure you have that little bit of independence so that you can run away.
Barbara, you've hit the nail on the head, though. You two started in what you said as a very even salaries before you decided to take the time out.
Well, we did by the time I decided to take the time out. But originally my husband's English. So he left a job in England, of course, to come here with nothing, like to set up a business from scratch. So initially I was the breadwinner and he was trying to build
a
business.
So there had been that dynamic shift between the two of you, and then it shifted back to you earning no money and him bringing in being the breadwinner.
Yes.
The reality is that in a situation like that, it started more or less on an equal footing. I know he was behind at the start, but it started more or less and it was equal for a while and then it converted back over again. I think it's really important in that situation because what you talk about, the amount of work that you're doing raising the three kids, there's figures every year, kind of 48,000 euros year is what it costs to pay for the stay-at-home parent. But I think it's really important in that situation that the person who is at home has their own money too.
Owen McGee and Barbara Scully from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.